Okay. Well, how are you? Oh, now I don't hear you.
Hear me now?
Oh, I hear you now.
That's a problem. Okay. Can you hear me now?
I can hear you now.
Okay. The Verizon guy. There we go.
That's right. Well, how have you been?
I've been good. I think it's been a little over a year since I talked to you before. Okay. And it's kind of surprising to me that it's been that long. It's just time flies so fast. But I was thinking about well, maybe a few months back when you posted your new guidelines of only two.
Yeah.
Two
you
or
only
less.
Had one, so you still have
right,
one.
Right, right. I snuck right in under the but then also during that, you said that you really liked having those conversations of just like, what's your story?
Yeah.
And I kind of, when you were saying that, I kind of realized is like, I came in with like a bunch of agendas of like, this is what I want to talk about. So I thought it might be fun to have my story kind of thing, because I kind of went really quickly past that the last time we talked.
Okay.
So,
well, the whole experience, you know, the whole, I mean, this whatever it is that I'm doing is only 2 years old. So, you know, and you're on the Discord server now, and so the thing has continued to develop, and so and sort of the community too. So I can understand it's. Say, okay, I'd like to share a little bit more of myself. So I think that's a good thing.
Yeah. Yeah. I have so many different things. I've done a lot of things in my life, which is weird for me to say, cause I'm only 34, but, I have more than an hour's worth of material. So
all right, well, let's get after it.
So it's kind of whatever, I guess it's maybe what you're interested in. Like currently I am writing fiction,
right?
But I also spend a lot of time preaching in prisons. The church that I'm in has a prison ministry, and I go into prisons and teach classes and preach there. And I actually just finished a Bible class teaching at my church, going through Judges and Ruth. So that's on my mind. So that might come up at some point in there. And, but in my early 20s, early to mid 20s, I was a full-time preacher in, and I was in the Churches of Christ, and, which have their own little idiosyncratic kind of issues and everything. But a lot of times when you talk about being in and pastoring a small church, like a lot of the things that you talk about sometimes, I think it's like, I dealt with that. I know exactly how those dynamics go. And then I guess even going a little bit further back, I got a degree in political science with a minor in religion. So my interests and my careers has changed a lot. So I guess I've just given you a deck, and you choose the card.
Oh, wow. I don't know. I'm kind of interested in how you got into preaching.
Yeah.
And how you downshifted from it.
Right. Okay. Well, then that's a long story, but I put it out there. So I grew up in the Church of Christ. And my parents were very devout, like, you know, go twice on Sunday, once on Wednesday, every week. If there were special meetings, go to all those special meetings. And so I went there all the time. And both my mother and father's families have histories in the Churches of Christ. So I've got multiple preachers going back to a great-grandfather on one side and a grandfather on another side, and uncles. So I've got a lot of, so even like in family gatherings, it's just steeped in religion. even if nobody's talking about it. So there's a lot of that. So I guess a really quick go through of my religious history. I was baptized at 9. I went to college at 17, and I kind of had an atheist phase, and I came back to believing in Jesus and believing in the resurrection, partly thanks to my mom just on a whim sending me the Case for Christ in a care package. And it was like, and she didn't even know that I was going through this at the time, because I was away at college, and it was like right what I was dealing with. And I went through that whole book in one night.
Lee Strobel's book.
It answered all the questions and doubts that I was dealing with at the time. And it helped me bring me back to a faith, and a stronger faith, like my own faith kind of thing. During college, I got a minor in religion, which was basically my excuse to take a whole bunch of New Testament classes with this one professor at NC State named William Adler, who was just this fantastic professor. And he was just, he was big on, just ancient sources and reading the text and learning about the ancient world. And he opened up the Bible in a way that just made it like rigorous and historical, and really opened it up to me in a way that you don't always find in church settings. And so that really helped me as well. So how I got started preaching is while I was still in college and I was going through those things, I started getting more involved in church. Getting active, started teaching classes. Before that, even like just participating in classes, teaching classes, taking some classes with the local preacher there about like just how to make a sermon, do those kinds of things. Then I graduated from college. I had a political science degree, and I started working for this nonprofit organization in North Carolina, where I was living at the time. Basically, I was a junior lobbyist. I worked around the General Assembly in North Carolina, and I did everything that I could do legally, that unless you had to be a registered lobbyist. And it was kind of a temporary job. It wasn't quite full time, but that was what I was doing. A thing of, I guess, maybe just to explain the story, the Churches of Christ kind of have their own unique way of going about raising up preachers and training them. There's not too much of a seminary training that goes in, but it's almost like a lot of churches will go through kind of an apprenticeship training kind of thing. Like you find a preacher who's willing to kind of take you under his wing and teach you the ropes and give you things to work through and come. And so that was, there was this church out in Wichita, Kansas that was offering this kind of program. And I got two emails, an email from my dad and an email from one of my uncles, who both got this email that they said they were looking for. And they said, well, why don't you try that out? And it was a 1-year program. And they said, well, you know, try it out. If it's something that you'd like to do, then that's great. And if not, it's only a year. And so, and you can just go back to whatever you're doing. You're young, you can do whatever you want. And so I tried out. They flew me out, and I basically preached the only sermons that I ever wrote. There were like two sermons, and I exhausted all the sermons I ever wrote.
Yeah,
and they decided to take me on, and so that's how I kind of got started preaching. But then the way out is an even longer story. So it turned out that
in your church, are most of your preachers bivocational, or are they supported by the church? How does that go?
It depends church to church, because churches of Christ are each congregation is independent of the other. So some of them will support full-time preachers or multiple preachers, and some the preachers are both bivocational. This man
is the ordination only in a particular congregation, or is it an ordination in the denomination?
So,
I mean, because these things differ by denominations.
So technically, there is no ordination process because the Churches of Christ don't have a structure that goes beyond
the local church, the congregational. Yeah,
yeah. There is no there is no superstructure above that delegates what can or cannot. So basically, I get purposes is basically the congregation ordains the preacher. If they hire the preacher and they are okay with the preacher, then the preacher is ordained essentially. But it's not a formal process, and it's not anything like that. So it is a little bit different than a lot of other denominations and everything that go along with that. And it can definitely have its downsides, which I will probably proceed to tell you about here. The man that I worked under, he was at the time bivocational. So he was working at his own business, but he was also at the same time being paid to preach. So the Churches of Christ, the leadership structure, we tend to separate pastor from preacher, and so we have our eldership as the pastors, or that's what we say. At the church that I was at, there were three pastors, and that preacher was also one of the pastors. So I know it sometimes this is like, to get into some of this is like really inside baseball stuff.
Yep. That's the way churches are.
Sometimes it's hard to like succinctly describe it. Yep. But hopefully that kind of makes a little bit of sense. He began to have, well, it's not that he began to have, he was having issues with the way that he was preaching. There would be families that would leave or get really just, they wouldn't like his preaching, because he would get very confrontational. He would get very aggressive. A lot of people didn't like that. And eventually, it got to the point where the other two elders basically told him that it was time for him to leave, or for him to step down.
Yeah.
But since he was also an elder, he turned it around and basically made this power dispute between him and the other two. And I kind of got caught in the middle of it. And basically he ended up taking a third of the congregation away with him. It was already a fairly small congregation, about 70 to 80 people. And he ended up taking about 25 to 30 people away. And while that happened, I was actually in New York State at the time, because I was actually trying out a congregation. I was going to actually start preaching somewhere else. But then that all happened. And at the time, I was 23. I'd been preaching for just a little bit over a year underneath this man. And now I'm like put into this position where everything's falling apart. I'm kind of like this naive, idealistic kind of person that says like, well, churches shouldn't split. People should get along. We're all brothers and sisters in Christ. Can't we fix this? And can't we adjudicate this and decide this? And I spent a lot of time like going to each individual family that left and talking to them and giving them, you know, what I was thinking. I would go to the other people who were upset, and there were several people who didn't leave with the other preacher, but were like, why am I going to church anyway? And I had to go to them and talk to them and convince them, no, it's okay it's okay to keep coming to church, and I hope you do. And also another unique aspect of that congregation. So as I was 23, just especially this is maybe something about Wichita, Kansas too, is people move away from Wichita, Kansas when they get to like 18. So there's not a lot of people in their 20s in that particular town. Wow. So there was the next youngest person in that congregation was 16 years old. And the next oldest person was in their 30s. And so I was like in this demographic of my own. And so I was also like the de facto youth minister. And I spent a lot of time, a lot of the kids in that split were dealing with like, why do our parents suddenly not let us talk to each other? Or why do they do this? And they're also like dealing with, well, I thought Jesus was about love and all this other stuff, and now there's not all this stuff going on. So I was just like trying to do all this other stuff. I thought like, if I just try hard enough, if I say the right things, everybody will come back. Things will kind of like mend. Instead, the preacher that I had formerly been working with and who had taken that group started spreading lies about me, not only to the people that he took away, but he also had a mailing list of about 20, 25,000 people. And he started spreading that around to like people all over, talking about basically how he was right and so my name got spread to a lot of emails at the time.
Wow.
And then he'd send me emails sometimes multiple times a day harassing me. And it got to the point that I got so depressed. This was 2008. So this was about 11 years ago. And I remember it was New Year's Day, 2009. I had just gotten like barraged by some emails of his, and I was just laying in bed and just like, I don't even know if I want to go on. And then somebody who I kind of knew, because I had been doing like teen studies with not only the teens of my congregation, but some other congregations in the area. And one of the fathers of those teens, he just called me out of the blue and he said, I've been getting these emails that this guy's been sending, and I want to tell you, don't believe any of it. Like most of the people, the people who will actually read those, they'll be able to read between the lines and see that he's trying to say something that's not true.
Yeah.
And it was like one of the most helpful things that had ever happened to me, because I was like, I didn't want to go on. Like I was so depressed. And it took a good maybe year before I started like kind of getting back to normal-ish.
Yep.
And basically the remaining two elders asked me to stay on as kind of a temporary preacher until they found somebody else. And then after about another year, they decided, okay, well, you're doing a pretty good job, so why don't you stay another couple years? In the process of doing that, I ended up going on a mission trip to South Africa, where I found that his emails had even gone out there. And then, about 2012, I just kind of felt like it was time for me to move on from that congregation. and to find something else. And so I even though they had offered to just keep me on indefinitely, it just felt like it was,
yeah,
it's hard to explain. It just felt like it was the right move to just move on.
Yeah.
And I ended up in Huntsville, Alabama, and I was planning on finding another church and just kind of ping-ponging, because my parents were living in Huntsville, Alabama at the time. I was just going to stay with them and then ping-pong and find another place. And then I didn't. And then I found the woman who would become my wife. And then I married her. And Huntsville, Alabama is like right smack dab in the middle of the Bible Belt. And they have more preachers than they can deal with. But also Huntsville is, the other jobs are engineer and programmer. And I don't have that. So I kind of transitioned to the other thing that I like doing is telling stories. And so I started writing and just kind of pursuing that and preaching as the opportunities kind of arose.
Yeah.
That's why I am where I'm at. In some ways there's kind of a relief of not preaching and being paid for it,
mm-hmm,
because I think maybe you can commiserate with this, but I think, well, at least when I was young, I would think, am I preaching this because I believe it, or am I preaching it because I'm getting paid, or am I preaching enough? Or am I backing off because maybe I'll offend somebody, and then they'll start the thing of like, well, why are we even paying this guy? Why? And even though like none of my choices were consciously, oh, I better not say that because then this will be, but then I would think, is my subconscious like self-editing myself? And so when you're not paid to preach, that does free you up a little bit to like say, well, clearly I'm not self-editing myself for fear of losing a paycheck because I already don't have one.
Yep. Yep. So, yep. Yep.
So it has its benefits not being paid to preach. You know that if you're still doing it, you know that you're doing it for more altruistic reasons.
That's right. That's right. That's right. That's true. That's very true.
So that was a really quick go through of that. That's kind of,
the email list of 20,000 people, that's unusual, but just about every other part of the story is not that unusual. Church splits and fights and bad mouthing. And I mean, I'd love to say that these things don't happen in the church, but
yeah,
they certainly do.
Yeah. And that's, I originally, when I signed up, I kind of said that I was thinking in terms of your channel and the people that listen, and I'm one of them. I voraciously like listen to all of your stuff at least as much as I can while I have the time to. but you end up talking to a lot of people who are looking into church or other kinds of things, But I also see the other thing with my generation and maybe the generation behind me is that a lot of us are giving up on church. And sometimes when I talk with people who are my age or a little younger and I ask them, well, why did you stop going to church or something else like that? And then they'll tell me the reason and it won't even be anywhere close to all the stuff that I went through. And then... either like then I get this like thought of like and sometimes in the conversation they'll be like, well, yeah, why are you still going to church? Like, you should leave too, kind of thing. Like, it's the obvious thing. If you leave because the church is filled with hypocrites or filled with these people who are gonna hurt you, well, you experience like I experienced that firsthand. And one of the things I'll even say is to people is the worst people that I've ever personally experienced with or dealt with have been church people.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah,
but yeah, also some of the best people I've ever worked with and experienced with are church people as well. And So it's not the fact of being a church person that makes them a good person or a not so good person. I might just go ahead and go on a little bit of a spiel, because I think in that process of going through that, of being kind of persecuted by a former mentor and feeling like at the depths of despair, I started reading about David and Saul. It's one of those things, is like suddenly the story became real. Like it wasn't just a Bible story. It was this is real. I'm experiencing this. I'm experiencing, and I was like, this is my cave in Adullam moment where David's at his lowest point. And then people just out of the blue start coming. And like that man that I talked about, they just came out of nowhere and just gave me a word of encouragement. Yeah. And I started reading the Psalms, and suddenly the Psalms were more than just places to go for proof texts of doctrine or something else like that. It's like, these are real emotive things that people go through, and I found great comfort in those. And they suddenly became a part of me. And so in some ways, some weird ways, it's like the Bible became more real to me because that happened to me. I think Paul puts that in that a certain way in Romans, when he kind of compares Pharaoh and Moses. Like, Moses wouldn't be Moses without Pharaoh.
Yeah. Yeah.
David wouldn't be David without Saul.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
And so without suffering, you wouldn't necessarily be what you end up being. And that's the same with Jesus Christ as well. But then the more that I've thought about that for myself is like, why do I stay in church? And why do I stick with these people and some people that hurt me? And you even go to church and people don't always, you know, it might not be as bad as that particular preacher, but people don't treat you as well as maybe they ought or something else like that. The text I always go to is John chapter 6, where the people come to Jesus after he fed the 5,000, and they're like, well, feed us again. And then Jesus starts this long, convoluted teaching where he ends saying, you've got to eat my flesh and drink my blood. And I've whenever I've preached that sermon, I say, "What?" And then the people say, is he saying that we should be cannibals? And then Jesus said, oh, no, I'm speaking in metaphor. don't get the wrong idea. I'm not talking about cannibalism.
They weren't paying him either.
He says, you're right. I am talking about cannibalism. You've got to eat me. Eat my flesh. Drink my blood. And nobody understands, and it's so difficult, or it's so strange, that everybody leaves, and then Jesus is left with the 12.
Yeah.
And then Jesus says, are you going to leave me also? And then Peter answers, and Peter doesn't say, oh, no, Jesus, we understand that you're talking in a metaphor, and we understand all the deep significance. No, Peter says, where else are we going to find eternal life? Peter says, we're just as confused as everybody else, but we know there's nowhere else to go.
Yeah.
And I feel like that's kind of where I am in my spiritual journey, is that even in terms of being disappointed in church or disappointed in specific people in the church, my faith isn't in the church. My faith is in Jesus. And even if I don't necessarily understand why I'm going through all the suffering that I'm going through, or why my life goes in this direction or that direction, where else can I go for eternal life?
That's right.
And that's right. So it seems to me like the question about church or spirituality or religiosity, it's not about, I mean, it does include things like living the good life and all the things that kind of come up with Jordan Peterson and philosophical things and everything else. But eventually it comes down to eternal life. Where does that reside? And it only resides in Jesus Christ. Like, and all the other things, they will freely admit, or at least especially all the naturalistic ones, that it doesn't end in eternal life. So, I mean, if that's already kind of out the window, like, but like, it's not founded. And like I said, it's not founded in that thing of wishful thinking or something else. It's founded in a belief that, well, that was really helpful with the case of Christ, the case for Christ, where it helped me get this idea of like, there are really good historical reasons to believe that Jesus rose from the dead, that it's not just a story. It's not just mythology. It does, it includes or maybe subsumes mythology and all these other things, but it's real. And the words that fudge, it's real too.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so I guess that's kind of, I feel for people when they leave the church because of hypocrisy or because of this or that. But then I think you're giving up so much more for a small inconvenience. And I think of like Jesus' story about the kingdom of heaven is like a pearl of great price. When a man sees it, he sells everything that he has in order to purchase it. And maybe that's the thing. Maybe that's the thing is, maybe a lot of people of my generation just don't realize the value of Jesus. And because if they did, they would go, they would get it. And so I struggle with this myself when I try to share with people or I preach or something like that. How do I connect what I've found to be so valuable to convince somebody else? And it's not my, but then it's not my power to convince somebody else that it's worth something.
Yeah.
That's the Spirit that's going to convince them that it's powerful. I feel like I'm rambling a bit.
No, that's fine. That's fine. You ramble well. I think constantly about these questions about church and people who de-church and why and where that goes and the effects that it has on them and the effects that church has on them or on others. Part of human beings do a lot of things that we are not necessarily conscious of. And the rider on the elephant makes up a lot of stories that may or may not have a lot to do with the actual motivated structure of the elephant. Mm. And, church is one of these things. There are a lot of things in life that the consequences of decisions may not be known or felt even by the person who has made the decision. I think about my great-great-grandfather that decided to send my great-grandfather on a boat out of Rotterdam over to Western Michigan to, what could he have envisioned the consequences for that decision? One of the things that he obviously didn't know in the 1890s was that, Adolf Hitler would overrun the Netherlands in the 1940s. And so one of the things that he did was save his family from the Holocaust.
Yeah, but
how could he have known that?
Yeah.
and somehow I don't have the story. I don't know why, somehow these Jews started going to the Dutch Reformed Church. They converted from Judaism to Christianity. And then his grandson became a Christian Reformed minister and took churches out in the West. And then his great-grandson, who he never met, That would be my father. He, you know, took a church in Paterson, New Jersey. And I mean, it just, all these things just,
yeah,
out they go. And well, we can think about them in terms of chance, but yeah. What's so funny is that almost nothing in that chain of events was chancy. It was, there's, mm-hmm. you know, that it was the decisions that, you know, big and small that shaped the paths. And now we didn't have foreknowledge so that we could say, well, if I decide this, then this will happen. And if I decide this, then this will happen. Didn't have that available because there's no way to know, but it's all full of decisions. And, you know, what part of what I see happening in the United States is that I think over the next 20 years that a lot of churches will close.
Yeah.
A lot of churches will close. And there's going to come a point when these churches are missed, because a lot of the kinds of things that these churches do, churches, you know, when I had my conversation with Sevilla King, you know, she talked about, she was working in a clinic and she hadn't been terribly religious, but she began to have an appreciation for the amount of implicit mental health work that churches do, helping people cope in right. poverty or difficult marriages, and churches coming alongside new mothers and visiting shut-ins and yeah. taking care of people who wander in and need a little bit of help with food or gas yeah. money. And all those things would
cost money for if you would hire somebody to do all those things.
Yeah, right? if the state does it,
yeah, you
know, it's tremendously expensive. But churches just sort of do this. And a lot of people who are not aware of that just look and say, well, those are just these little private clubs that just get together. And it's like, well, there's an aspect that's sort of like that. But yeah. there's also a whole lot of other things, you know, where your AA meetings going to happen, where are your NA meetings going to happen, where are, you know, and all of these little things, which is actually part of the logic behind, you know, donation receipts and, you know, all this sort of special tax stuff that churches have. But, you know, that was sort of built in a generation that appreciated a lot of the soft impacts that churches have, not only in the lives of the people who attend there,
yeah,
but the community outside of the church.
Mm-hmm.
And then when you think of it was so funny with my conversation with I don't know quite now to say his name, the Vosh guy that I did that little debate with. I don't know if you watched that.
Yeah, well, I saw the clip that you put. Yeah. I think you posted it on the 1st of November, the 1st yeah, or 2nd of
yeah,
November.
Yeah,
you,
a recent
you,
video.
I saw that clip, but I just haven't had time to go watch the whole thing. But yeah.
there'll be fewer videos over the next 2 weeks than I usually have, and some people will complain, yeah. but for those who want to catch up.
It's all right. It'll give me time to catch up.
That's right.
So I'm not complaining.
There's a chance to catch up. But you know, I'm talking to him, and he – very much an atheist and holds positions that are very different from mine or many Christians. And, you know, and he's just talking about wistfully about, you know, well, how can we encourage groups of people to be more selfless and to be more giving and to be more communitarian? And towards the end of the video, I said, if only there was a place where people could go once a week and hear a motivational speech about how to be selfless and to practice giving and you know, it'd be like you'd just invent the church all over again. But
it's a reinvent the wheel.
That's right.
But I think at least from what I saw from that conversation is though it's reinvent the wheel at least partially without the sexual ethics. Yeah. around it. That's at least part of it, right?
Yeah. Well, and what's so funny is that, well, not funny really, but the role that, you know, all churches talk about sex. Well, part of the reason churches talk about sex is because churches are close-knit, intimate communities. And I see practices, I see sort of
spiritual communities that develop around practices that, you know, that the practices themselves aren't bad or anything and are often enjoyable and they help build community. But you know what? If you've got, groups of people coming together to join community, guess what happens between those people?
Yeah.
Attractions develop.
Right.
You know, and so part of the reason churches have maintained fairly traditional sexual ethics is because you have a history of, well, you know, people at work. So now we have all these rules at work. You have all these very puritanical rules at work regarding sex. Right. And then people are like, well, why do churches talk about sex? Because when people get together,
right,
sparks fly. And if sparks fly in a community, it explodes the community. So workplaces have, you know, no dating unless you, and their rules in workplaces are in some ways even more authoritarian than in churches. Yeah. But they realize just by it via experience that you had to have it because people are people. So
yeah. There was something you brought up. What was his name?
Vaush or something.
Something like that. There was something interesting about that because it seemed to me, at least in that section that I was listening to, he was also saying, well, here's a problem. And what if we come up with this solution, this kind of commune solution? And he started coming up with all these rules and everything. And I was thinking, like, you've brought up the Oneida community before. Yes. Is like, well, people have tried those kind of free love community kind of things, and they've all disintegrated. They didn't last very long, or if they do, they're very small and very isolated. But even in that, this might sound a little weird, but it kind of sounds like a little bit of like a Tower of Babel kind of thing. Like, the people in the Tower of Babel, they say, let's make a name for ourselves. It's like, we can do it. Like, we have these problems. We can do it. We can build it. And then in the Tower of Babel story, it says, you know, God confused the languages. And this is one of the things that I really appreciate about Jordan Peterson's Bible thing, because he went into like all sorts of areas with the Tower of Babel that it was just like, wow. But I think sometimes when people read that story, they think God just makes this arbitrary choice.
Yeah. Yeah,
of like,
yeah. Or he's just going to be mean to.
Yeah. He's like, these people, they better not like make this. So I'm going to confuse the languages. And what I really appreciate about how Jordan Peterson put it is when people kind of like gather together and they start, is like, we're going to set this rules and we're going to set the rules and we're going to have this perfect community, is that if it gets big enough, eventually people are going to have different ideas about what's best moving forward. And it's as if they are speaking different languages.
And
eventually it's going to crumble.
Yeah.
No matter how well conceived, no matter how perfectly thought out the plans for this tower are going to be, eventually people are going to come to different ideas about what's the best next step. And that's, you know, it might not be this generation, but it's going to be, you're thinking, okay, what's a good system for us right now? But you're not thinking about what's a good system for the generations, 4, 5, 6 steps down the line. Are they going to think that your creation was all that brilliant? Or are they going to come up with their own idea about how to set up a more perfect system? But each one of them will have a different idea about a more perfect system, and they'll all split off. That's what will happen. And I think that that's part of like the problem of relying on ourselves to save ourselves. Like that seems to me to be the problem with, I guess, what he was proposing is that, but then it's also like, even in the cases, like, can you even get a whole bunch of people together to agree? And then do you have to give up some of your ideas in order to compromise with all these other people in order to have the perfect system? But then is it the perfect system because you just made all these compromises? And so going back, maybe getting back to church, is that you're, especially, so when you're a young person, you're in your 20s, and you're even, you're a preacher, and you think, okay, I know, well, you might even be a kind of humble 20-ish-year-old preacher, and you say, well, I don't know everything, but I do know that this needs to change, this needs to change, we need to be better at this, we need to do better at this, we need to do this. And then you think, okay, well then, I'll preach a sermon on that, I'll preach a sermon on this, I'll preach a sermon on this, I'll go over to this person and I'll tell them about how they need to straighten this out, and I'll come over here and I'll fix all the problems of the church. 2.5 months. It doesn't work that way. and you find out, even if you think you expressed yourself perfectly, and even if you go to the person who maybe is like the cause of like some friction and you say, well, what'd you think about the sermon? And they'll say, well, you made some good points. I agree with you that this, this, and this is in the Bible and that's what I should do. I'm not going to do it. and then where do you go from there?
Oh, that's right. That's right.
And you learn that like living in community is actually living in community. It's not about, it's not about everything that I believe or I think should go and how I imagine the perfect world. That's how it's gotta be or else I'm out. And so you learn a great deal of humility in giving up your own preferences, giving up your own feelings about what would be ideal, and kind of in a sense saying, I will live with these people who don't understand it as good as I do. And then in the process, you start to find out that, well, maybe it's the other way around. Maybe I don't know. And they actually know more than me. And that's, but you don't like, you don't get there unless you kind of go through, at least for me, you don't get there unless you go through
not
that.
Not just process. You, trust me, yeah. Not just you. Well, and what the church then provides people, which they, of course, give absolutely no thought to, is, well, you got all these ideas that you're infatuated with about how everything should be and how the world should be. Well, why don't you actually try living right. and having significant relationships with a broader network of people, not mediated by, you know, of course, a job. Well, there's a hierarchy and a structure and a job to hold it together, but a much more, a much more voluntary organization when, especially in today, people can just hear, they'll leave the church over just about anything you could imagine. You know, yeah. I don't like, they all put in burgundy chairs and I thought blue was right. Right. I can't be with these people, you know, shake the dust off their feet on their way right. out the parking lot. this is people. And so, okay, so you got some big idea and you're going to turn the world upside down and all right, well, give it a shot. Where are you going right. to start?
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
That, I'm going to go on YouTube and tell everybody how they should live. All
right. Right.
Exactly. YouTube channels are free. Get a Gmail address. Off you go.
Yeah. Yeah. Change the world.
That's right. Yep. Go ahead. You go change that world. Have at it.
So that makes me think, and this is also like one of my favorite things about that I've gotten from Jordan Peterson is his biblical series. And, I know he's going through stuff right now, so I wouldn't want to like put it on the plate, but in a perfect world of my creation, he would go on to do Exodus because
be nice. And
he says that he's thought about Exodus a lot more than Genesis. So if that's true, I really want to hear about that.
Yeah.
But I think about that with Moses, right? Moses is in this privileged place and he sees the Egyptians persecuting the Hebrews, and he says, that's not how it should be. I know how it should be. And then he goes and he murders the Egyptian, and he saves this Hebrew. And then he goes, and then the next day he finds the Hebrews fighting. And he comes in, he's like, we shouldn't be fighting. And then they come and they say, oh, you're the guy who's going to free us from the Egyptians.
You're the guy who killed the Egyptian. Oh, you heard about that?
Right. I think it's in Stephen's sermon where Stephen says, Moses thought he was going to basically start a revolution.
Yeah.
And he was 40 years old. And he was kind of naive at 40, so that makes me feel better about my naivety at a different age. But in part, like, Moses has to wait not just for him to see that things need to change, but he has to wait 40 years, and then God, I think the language, I can't remember quite off the top of my head, but God says something along the lines of, the Israelites are now calling for me. Or I've heard their cry or something like that. And so it can't just be that Moses sees the need for change. There needs to be at least a sizable number of people that say, yes, there needs to be change. So Moses had to wait 40 years before
and then he didn't want to do it.
That he was planning on making.
Well, but God then it had was to talk different. Him into it.
right. And then God had to talk him into it, right? Exactly. Then he was like, yeah, no, I was over that.
That's right. That was my 40s. You know, right. That was my 30s. I didn't know anything then. Save right. those people. And then, of course, it gets him into the desert. And, of course, he and God take turns wanting to, you know, I should have left these people to die somewhere. They're so miserable. All they do is complain.
Yeah.
It's like, people. Like,
yeah. Moses, like, you just, Moses dealing with other people is like, you learn so much studying Moses. And it says Moses, doesn't it say Moses was like the most humble man?
Yeah.
It's like, he learned it. That's how he became the most humble man.
Yeah. Oh, make me humble. Yeah, pray that right. prayer. Go ahead and pray for patience, too, while you're at it.
Right.
See how that goes for you. Have right. fun learning humility.
Yeah.
Yeah, you can learn humility.
Yeah, the be careful what you pray for. It's, oh, yeah.
Oh. Well. Look at the time.
Yeah. Well.
Did you get everything in you wanted to get in?
Well, so the first conversation, I had those ideas. And I tried to come into this one with a little bit more I'll live a little bit more by faith and just kind of see where it goes. So
I think this was good. I'm glad you told this story because something that I really dislike trying to do evangelism by promoting church as a panacea. Mm. And because I don't want someone to get into church and say, you told me to go to church and I went in there and these people were miserable and they were mean to each other. And it's like, yeah actually that's the plan. Well, who would join that? Well, actually, well, is it any different from family? You know, families mean to, people say things to their family members they would never say to a person on the street because family is stuck with you. And actually you should watch that debate because it was so interesting to me because he keeps talking about all these noble ideas about people choosing to live in community and all that. And I made the comment that actually the more affluent a society gets, the smaller family size gets. And I don't mean just pure number of children. I mean people living alone because people are so miserably hard to live with. And so actually, if you want people to live together, if they're less wealthy, they will because they can't afford to. And there's at least the possibility, but absolutely no guarantee
that in having to actually live with another human being, you might learn that the problem isn't always on the other side of the fence. And that's a valuable thing to learn. Yeah. And if you can learn that, and if you can actually do something about it, well, then you've actually begun to grow and to become a, you know, to become a more powerful person and a humble person and a good person. And, you know, that's not necessarily part of the Jordan Peterson corpus that gets a lot of attention, but it's in there.
Yeah, it is in there. Like, it's, what does it say? It's like, pick up your bloody cross and carry it up the hill. Like, that's part of the whole thing.
Well, and when he talks about his marriage too, because he says, okay, well, you have a fight with your spouse. Suppose you win. Do you really want to be married to a loser? I mean, at some point, and, you know, some of the stories he tells about, you know, trying to figure out his marriage early on, and, you know, I'm sure he doesn't have a perfect marriage. Nobody in this world has a perfect marriage. But, you know, but well, doggone it, you figure it out. And then he tells the story where just had a fight with his wife and, you know, temperamentally she's sleeping like a baby and he's still angry. And you've been married a while, you know these things. And you, right. And then, okay, so then you just had a fight with your wife and she's not upset anymore and you're still angry. And then, well, what are you going to do with yourself? And right there at that moment, now you've got an opportunity for growth. And so the next time something, you know, you're going to wake up in the morning and make amends and try and, you know, so, you know, people have all these highfalutin ideas and they're going to be wonderful to other people. And you're going to have polycules where three people can be in a marriage together. And I just think, you know, if you read the book of Genesis, you know, Jacob has Rachel and Leah. That's like one of those good
things, like people say, it's like, well, how can, you know, the Old Testament be like this from God? It's like, well, they have all these like plural marriages. Like, I don't know that the Old Testament puts those plural marriages in a very good light. Like, everybody that has it has some kind of problem.
That's right.
There's jealousy among wives, or it's just too many wives, and there's all these contests between children or just different things that just leads to all these problems that, I don't know. Yeah. It's definitely the majority of plural marriages, aren't the best or aren't the happiest.
Well, even regular marriages, it's hard enough with one other person. You know, you're going to bring another one into this. It's like, really? That's your plan? Well, tell me how it goes. You know, good old Dr. Phil, how's this working for you?
Right? you almost need just that kind of Texas mustache wisdom.
That's right. Oh, so you brought a third person in the relationship. How's that working for you?
Right.
Well, how long's it been? Well, 6 months. Let's give it a couple years. Right. See where this thing goes.
Yeah.
Oh.
I know you probably got to go, but I just had this thought along with those things, because I think maybe also part of the reason people are, or maybe these other modes of living, and they're potentially abandoning traditional marriage and everything, is, and I think I've felt this too, is that you get a lot of examples of how marriage goes wrong in your life, whether it's still married. But I had a lot of friends whose parents there were divorced or they dissolved, or, and even as I grew up, I saw people my age get married and get divorced and get married and get divorced in their 20s. And you start thinking, is like, this is not tenable. Yeah. But one of the things that I have found, and this is also a thing with church, is that you have examples of people who do it. And so my marriage is strengthened because I go to church and there's a lot of other people with marriages that have lasted, go to, and and get advice from and and just find assurance that this is a way that is tenable.
Yep.
So,
well, and you know, one of the things that churches do is they expand your social network.
Yeah.
And they expand your social network in a particular way. And, you know, they expand it, you know, even though, yeah, there's hypocrites and all kinds of crazy people in church. There's also some really good people in church. And so they bring you into contact with other people. And of course the church, because of the belief system and the structure, it frames it in a certain way. And, you know, the sociological data is very clear that people who, and not just who, you know, stumble into a church once or twice a year, but people who go to church regularly and apply themselves with, you know, with giving and volunteering and sacrificing to do this, they receive a considerable amount of benefits from this that don't seem directly related and associated with it, but you see it, you know, you see it out there in their lives. And again, this is part of the mystery of it, and that we think, well, I'm only going to do something that I can see the linear rational connection between thing that I do here A and outcome that I desire here B. Well, there are some things like that, but life is way bigger and more complicated than that. And so what you find is that wisdom is sort of a thing where you begin to do things even if you don't know for sure the good outcomes, but you look around and you say, and I've seen this before, people look around and say, they begin to notice a pattern, and they say, the people that I admire and aspire to be like are doing certain things. Now, I can't necessarily connect what I see them doing with what they're getting, but I'm just going to start doing some of the things that they do. It's kind of this reverse of mimetic desire. And get into that and see where that goes. And, well, you know,
it can work.
It can work. It can work. So.
Well, I appreciate you talking with me.
Oh, this is fun, Eric.
Yeah, I'm glad that I got in. It was several months ago when I was trying to find a spot. I'm glad I eventually found one. So
yeah, so you know what I'm doing with the spots is I look ahead in the calendar for about a month ahead, and then I see, okay, this week's, you know, some weeks get really busy. So then I might not have too many slots, but then some weeks are a little freer. So it's like, okay, I'll free open those slots. So they can kind of open up at any time.
Yeah.
It sort of randomizes the process.
Which is probably good, because I was just checking randomly like every couple weeks or something like that. It's like, oh yeah, I want to check and see. But eventually I got there. But
good.
I really appreciate you talking with me.
All right, Eric.
All right.
Do I have permission to share this?
Oh yeah. Yeah. Okay. Sure. Like you've said before is like, I've got nothing to lose. Like whatever I've experienced, I've already lost the big, so I've got nothing.
there's a guy who used his massive email to defame you. So what can this little YouTube do?
Well, yeah, I can't imagine. So it's perfectly good. So I hope you have a great day.
All right. Thanks, Eric.
All right.
Take care.
Thank you. You too.
Bye-bye.
Bye.